All right, we'll call the meeting of the Agricultural Economies and Veterans Affairs Committee to order. Representative Brown was here and reviewed the minutes of March 24th and moves their approval. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye, opposed. Minutes are approved. Again, members, today we have four or five bills. Some will take a couple minutes, some will take a little longer, but all the bills we're hearing today will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. With that, we're going to fire right up with House File 411, Olin, and the chair moves that before the committee and for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I'm going to make a couple quick comments, and that's enough on that. But first off, what I am going to say is leaving it in the omnibus bill is fine if that's the way you want to handle it. I do understand, for what it's worth, the Senate did refer it in directly to General Register because I'm trying to use money that was in the 07 budget. But either way, it's fine with me. And I will let Dr. Hartman explain what this one individual cattleman's problem is in the actual bovine TV area, because Dr. Hartman and I have talked to the guy a million times, but I think Dr. Hartman actually talked to him more often than I have.
All right. Welcome. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. I'll just give you a little background on this fund that we have. It is a bovine tuberculosis indemnity fund. It was appropriated to the board in fiscal year 2008, $100,000. That money was by statute specifically for cattle producers who tested their herd for bovine tuberculosis and found suspect animals in their herd, and those animals had to be sacrificed for diagnostic purposes. The fund is available until spent, so it's know your money. We initially started making payments out of this fund, and the federal government then, since that time, has been paying indemnity on these suspect animals. So what the statute said that it was, if the federal government couldn't pay it, then this money was available to the state to pay it. There is approximately $72,000 left in this fund, and what this bill would do would be to allow the Board of Animal Health to use this indemnity fund to compensate a cattle producer who was in the buyout program. So up in our bovine tuberculosis management zone, you remember we passed a bill that offered a buyout to these cattle herds so we'd get the cattle herds out of the area where there are infected deer. This person signed a contract for the buyout, and when he sent his cows to slaughter, we found three of them infected with bovine tuberculosis. So in the investigation, then we went back to his farm and we looked at what he had left on his farm, and he had, I believe it was 25 calves that were left. Normally in the buyout, he would have been able to sell those calves on the open market if they were spayed and castrated. And because of finding TB in his herd, he couldn't do this. So he had to, we quarantined those calves and they had to go to slaughter. So there was a loss in value from those calves on the open market versus their slaughter value, and this bill would allow us to use this indemnity fund to pay him for that loss. I don't know exactly, we won't know exactly what that will amount to until we do an appraisal and find out what he got the value at slaughter, but we're estimating somewhere between $10,000 and $15,000. Okay, and Dr. Hartman, or what's the time frame on that? When do you expect to have the appraisal done and everything to write a check?
Mr. Chairman, as soon as the law is changed, the board would be able to move ahead, and we're able to do that pretty quickly, so I would guess within a month we would have that done.
So what we can do, Representative Olin, is send this to the General Register. It'll have to go through finance on the way out, but and then we can also put it in our omnibus bill. We can go both routes, and whichever one is first, because putting it on General Register doesn't mean you get it done quicker than the omnibus bill either. So, but we can do both if you want, because it's not have anything to do with this year's fiscal budget. Any questions, members, on this?
All right. Well, seeing none, Representative Olin, anything else?
One quick comment.
I want to get you out of here.
You can. I would be content to put it on both if that would be all right.
We will.
The other two quick comments, actually. The other thing that he didn't mention is, in defense of this guy, he did have his cattle tested both years that they were on the farm under the regular program, and for some reason the tests always showed negative. So it was a shock when they got to the cattle yard that anything showed up on the cows that did show up on.
All right. All right. So I'll amend my motion, members, that House File 411 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register via finance. Any more discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Bill passes.
Thank you.
Doty. Representative Doty moves that House File 1055 be recommended to pass and be actually recommend to bring before the committee for consideration in the omnibus bill. Members, this is a clean water fund bill. As you know, there's been about $9 or $10 million requested from clean water from the Department of Agriculture, and certainly this enters that mix also. I'm still not 100% sure what they're doing with the clean water funds, whether we put them in our bill and the whole bill ends up traveling to Mary Murphy's committee on the way out, or whether we'll get a target on clean water from finance, or I'm not sure they know either. So for now, we're just going to keep it here and lay it over, and if the point comes where we have to send all the clean water stuff out, we'll do that on a day and get it moving wherever we have to. But you have time because you're in finance right now. Representative Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your patience as you wait to find out what's happening with these. This proposal is the initial phase of what is planned to be a long-term 10-year project, and I think it's a very important project that we know exactly what's happening out there. I have with me today Rich Biskey from the Nature Conservancy, who will actually involved in the planning of this project, so he's way more suited to talk to you about the specifics than I am.
Welcome. Introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Rich Biskey.
Can you spell your last name for us for the record?
B-I-S-K-E.
All right.
I'm with the Nature Conservancy in Southeast Minnesota. What the project is, Southeast Minnesota's unique resource area due to our unique geology. It's very steep, highly erodible land, and yet not much is known about the effectiveness of the best management practices that we utilize on agricultural land. What are we getting in response for the different practices we use? This project aims to quantify the effects within fields in different areas of the Root River watershed, working with producers, evaluating those effectiveness and how they're used by farmers within a 3 to 5 year period, but with the hope that we can extend this out to 10 years to really assess what the effects of the climate differences are year to year. What we will find at the end of this is just which practices are going to be most cost effective for cleaning up the water resources in Southeast Minnesota, working with local farmers, agency folks, and ag groups.
Okay. Any questions, members, to the bill? Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is in the constitutional amendment we passed last year, it said that the money that comes from the increase in the tax is not supposed to, I think the word is supplant or something along that line, any of the money that is currently being spent. So this is a new program, is what I understand. So this is not taking, canceling old money that was going into clean water or anything like this. This is a totally new program, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you very much.
In the Nature,
Mr. Biskey,
Mr. Chairman, members, in the Nature Conservancy is contributing about $500,000 towards this project as well.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author and then to the testifier. Just the other day, I was reviewing the TMDL that was done on the river, and I was showing the two branches of the river that are in the district that I represent that are impaired. And I was just reviewing this in a report done by the MCCA, and others have been involved. And I know in the past for clean water dollars, the clean water legacy that we've passed, and the dollars that were appropriated, money went to, I believe, Bowser Soil Water Conservation District, DNR, MPCA. And so I'm wondering at this point why we're going to go with the Department of Agriculture. So could you please just fill me in on why the dollars are going to the Department of Agriculture? And then second question to that would be, there's been a lot of work done in the Soil Water Conservation District, and I'm sure that there are best practices and that there has been monitoring and they've done the cost-benefit analysis. So my question is what you're looking for if you're going to be redundant.
Mr. Britsky. Mr. Chairman and members, first, to the first question, why Department of Agriculture? This bill came, it was a product of an LCCMR proposal that went through where Department of Agriculture was the sponsor. I think it was a carryover. Our local watershed partnership would be just as satisfied if it went to, say, the Fillmore Soil and Water Conservation District, that local entity that typically handles these things. I can't answer the specifics of why the Department of Ag was listed here specifically. We'd be open to change that. To your second point, regarding the work already being done, there have been a lot of BMPs implemented throughout the state of Minnesota. The evaluation of those BMPs have often been done on, say, a research farm, or we use literature done by NRCS at a national scale. There is not much done, if any, in southeast Minnesota or the Driftless area, done at the field scale to really evaluate how they work in the real, quote-unquote, the real-world scenarios. We have assumptions. We have lots of assumptions on how effective these are at a larger scale, because that's typically what how monitoring is done. These are areas of probably no less than 10,000 acres, but more typically, say for the TMDLs, for example, at hundreds of thousands of acres. It's difficult to tell what's working, what's not working at that scale. What we're looking at is a tiered approach, whereby we look at a size of a field that's 80 acres. We can isolate all those variables at that scale. We then move it up to larger fields, say 250 acres, and then that larger sub-watershed that still is less than 5,000 acres, where we have direct one-on-one contact with those producers. We develop and procure data from each individual field, not at a watershed, but we get their soil samples, their nutrient management, and those things. So it's a much finer scale of assessment than what's typically done by, say, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, which is larger. So it's new in that respect.
Okay. The only other suggestion I have for you folks, especially you, Mr. Biskey, you might want to check in with Bowser also. They are working on a bill I had actually introduced, and they're combining with a number of bills to do limited at the first, but conservation plans for every farm that's in an impaired watershed district. And that's kind of what you're looking at here, and then hopefully drawing them into more programmatic things once that initial introduction is done to them on, you know, here's your soil types, your slopes, and this type of thing, and then offer them the programming that's available and see if they can't move. But priority to be given to that. So you might want to talk to John Jasky over there and see if this coordinates with what they're doing too. But that said, any other questions? Seeing none, House File 1055 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Olin. Doty. Olin, Doty, Ward.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Clark, House File 1747. The chair will move 1747 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And I'll also move at this point, members, the A1 amendment, and I will explain which one? A2 or A1? Do you know which one is the...
I haven't seen A2, but it's...
I haven't either, so... Colby, which one? Two?
Excuse me, we do want A2 because it did have a coordinating...
Forget about the A1.
That was added. Thank you.
We'll move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wants it. And members, this was a Hosh bill. And Representative Hosh, we're going to put it in here now for discussion.
and all this is going to be laid over for consideration. One of the things I've suggested, and I hope you will do, along with Representative Clark and all the other, I know you've been working with some people from the Humphrey Institute and other places, I've asked the department to get together with you in the next week and bring their Minnesota grown people in. You were here for those discussions too. I think a lot of this they're doing, or if we can add some language in our bill to what they're doing to facilitate some of this without actually setting up a large task force or that type of thing, that may suffice. But I think you should meet with them and discuss it with them, and I'm going to ask you to do that. But anyway, for now, let's put it on here. Again, this is just for possible consideration, members. So I move the A2 amendment. All those in favor, say aye. Aye. Opposed? That's amended. Representative Clark, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm bringing this bill as part of the Green Jobs Task Force work that was done over the interim and came to the state legislature this year, and I think a number of you are familiar with some of the work that's going on in the energy sector dealing with green jobs. Another part of that task force looked at the issue of food production, and it was looked at, I would say, in kind of a beginning way, and the language that you see in this bill actually came right out of that action plan and market study that was prepared by the task force, the Green Job Task Force, that Representative Kalin and Senator Anderson chaired, and there were members of both parties on that task force. So I asked Kate Parrish to come in and help talk with me about this, and I have some witnesses that really demonstrate the broad sector of folks that we are addressing in this group that we want to make sure get some resources. So some of the agricultural jobs that are being produced at the local level will get resources from the federal stimulus bill, and that we'll be paying attention to that in Minnesota. So the language that you see in the first Section 1, Green Jobs Food Production, was language that Kate and I helped craft and was approved and voted on by the committee. And the second part is the local food pilot that was also part of that discussion, and the language from there is what came out of that report, too. I think I'll turn it over to Kate. Some of you probably know Kate Parrish, and I'll let you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about her work on this.
Welcome.
Chairman, gentlemen, members of the committee, my name is Kate Parrish with AURI, and I had the opportunity of working with Representative Clark on the Green Jobs Task Force this fall. The task force looked at several things, at several opportunities that Minnesota has for maximizing job creation and retention in the new green economy. I think Representative Clark and our organization shared some concerns that maybe the food sector wasn't looked at as fully as we had hoped it would be. So the language that you're seeing before you is some of our hope that we are able to look at that a little bit more fully. We did work very hard to craft this language so that it's inclusive of all of Minnesota agriculture. We're of the hope that all of Minnesota agriculture can benefit from the opportunities presented by the green economy. And we are excited that Representative Clark included us on this bill, and we hope to continue working with her as well as members of this committee to address the concerns placed in the study.
Okay.
Representative Clark.
Notice that you'll note there's not a fiscal note on the first part because AURI is willing to work with us as long as we allow them to continue to have some of their current
funding. Assuming the study is contingent on us continuing to have funding.
Right.
Of course, there's a cost with any study like this. However, the work that we're doing currently, this builds on that, and we're hoping that it also presents us with some base work for some federal opportunities down the road.
Right. And members, so the second part of the bill, obviously that's contingent on federal stimulus dollars being appropriated to the state or available to the state, too, and we'll be continuing to monitor that. And, you know, we won't know that for a few months yet, but if and when it's available, then this is a directive as to how we utilize some of those dollars.
That's true, Mr. Chairman. I was just talking with folks a little bit about this morning. It is contingent. We don't know for sure what dollars are going to be coming. But I would like to call a few witnesses who can discuss how they would use these dollars. And there'll be both the folks who will be talking with us about the first part of the bill, and then some folks will be talking with us about the added part that the amendment, the commission. So if I could first call Winona Libby. And then Tamara down Square would be up to here.
Welcome, and the pages can get you whatever chairs you need there.
There we go.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself because we're on tape, and the tape knows who you are, and then proceed.
Okay. My name is Helene LeDuc. I direct the White Earth Land Recovery Project, and I'm here representing the Pine Point Farm to School Project on the White Earth Reservation. This is Greg Rasko, a student in the Pine Point Farm to School Program.
Very good. G-A-S-C-O?
Mm-hmm.
I spell Gaskell?
Yeah.
Yep, thumbs up to that. All right.
So go.
Yep, proceed.
Okay. Thank you very much for allowing us to testify here. Did you guys all get my literature? Little report on the Pine Point Farm to School Program. We're real proud of this program. White Earth Reservation, Pine Point School, 99% of the kids in that school qualify for the federal school lunch program for breakfast and lunch. I think the 1% is not my kid because I worked really hard to be middle class. So I'm like the only kid in the school. But everybody qualifies for that program. And we're kind of challenged because the school had a lot of trouble even just paying its food budget for the kids in there. They're scrambling a lot. We have a lot of issues with food in our community. One third of our population presently has diabetes. We got about a 70% increase in childhood diabetes in our community. And the BMI, you all know what the BMI index is, the body mass, I think that's what it's called. When the kids go into the school, 12% of them are overweight. By the time they get out, you got 60% are either overweight or obese by the eighth grade. So you have a very multiple set of dietary issues that are occurring in the school. As well, there are some concerns about ADHD in the school itself. So as a concerned parent and community member, our project does grow some food, and we work with Blue Cross Blue Shield. They helped us get some funding to start the program, and the Catholic Campaign for Human Development try to start a pilot project to look at this. And what we did is, you can see in this here is the report specifically on the project. What we offer, if you flip to the, you know, it kind of reports on it, but if you flip to the back two pages, you can see some of the food that we started to provide. And those are all from local farmers on our reservation and in the area surrounding our reservation. We're able to give these kids a lot of different kinds of foods that were fresh that they wouldn't have a shot at getting. We're able to, we had to get like a hamburger press so that they could press the buffalo meat into ham patties and all. And then our organization, Land Recovery Project, has a USDA certified food processing facility. We actually stole one of your guys from Ori to operate that for us, so we were all certified and good to go. So we're able to do that. We put about $30,000 into the local food economy with this project, which is a pretty cool thing for local farmers. The kids got a chance to do things. My son got a chance to do a lot of things, but they went and saw the buffalo. They went to a turkey farm, little local organic heritage turkey farm, where a tribal member ran the farm, who was from that school. She graduated from that school. So they got to see like a grown-up native person running a turkey farm. That was kind of cool. And they got to go pick the apples, pick the corn, rice processing. So it's been a good thing for the school. And the report here indicates kind of the general happiness index with it, you know. And there's a lot more pictures, but I know you guys are busy guys, so I didn't bring all that down. We had a couple challenges, I want to say. You had to retrain. This is what you have to think of in this, because everybody now just processes, reheats packaged food. So you have to retrain your kitchen staff, and you have to bring in prep cooks. Mm-hmm. Our project provides those. Cost us some money, but we thought it was worth it, you know. And it's just retraining for these skill sets that are like chopping carrots, cracking eggs instead of getting eggs out of a bag or dehydrated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, had to do that. And issues around, but our tribe works with us. Like our traditional foods are easier to get access, but there's challenges of having access to local foods. I want to say a couple other things. There's a good impact of this. There's a lot of tribes in the region are looking at this. Red Lake, Leech Lake, other communities sent representatives over because of the health issues. when you relocalize your food economy, you have less dyes and preserved foods in it. And so that has a good effect on the ADHD. And then the local foods, it turns out that eating a lot more traditional foods is better for your diabetes. It's, those older varieties are much healthier for you, buffalo meat and things like that in our community. So there's a lot of interest in that. It also helped feed into our interest. We plowed 200 gardens on our reservation last year. A lot of people in the housing projects were interested in gardening. And so we felt like it's synergistic. You know, how one thing encourages another thing and there's more interest in the local foods itself. The last thing I want to say, and I don't know if my son has anything to say here. This here is called the Food Sovereignty Report. I brought this to you because it has larger implications for your rural food economy. That is to say, we have 54% unemployment on our reservations. Yeah, that's what the statistics say. And yet, we did a study of households on our reservation and tribal expenditures, excluding casinos. We find that our tribe spends $8 million on food. $7 million of that goes to Food Service of America, Walmart, Sodexo, other corporate buyers, when, in fact, we could buy more of that locally and support local food economy, and in that process circulate money in our community. And so this is an institutional model, our farm-to-school, but it has broader implications for local economies, not just reservation economies, but all rural economies in our area. So we've been real encouraged by this, and we're really hopeful that you'll consider supporting. This is the first tribal farm-to-school program in the country. I don't know if you know that. We're pretty cool. We're out testifying at some national meetings this week. People are really interested in it, and we're really proud of it and our model. And my son here, he's an example of kids get to eat good, and he likes his food there. So thank you.
Good. Very good. Any questions for Ms. Ledoux? And again, we appreciate the testimony. We know what's going on in some of our other school districts. I liked your report. I know even Wilmer, where I'm from, they're trying to get local foods into the lunchroom, and they're doing it with some success, but I've never seen a comprehensive list like you provided here of all the local growers that are contributing, and that's certainly what we want. We have a lot of farmers market people around and local growers that really do want to do this also. Any other questions? Who else do you have there, Representative?
I'm just wondering if Gray might like to tell us his favorite food, or can you take a moment to do that?
Tell us what your favorite food is. We'll see if we agree.
Salad.
Salad.
Nice.
Oh, man. Wow. When I was your age, I wouldn't even eat salad. So.
But that's where you get fresh.
That's good. True. It tastes better, doesn't it? Well, that's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tamara Downs-Schwy with the Community Design Center of Minnesota.
All right.
Go ahead. So, Community Design Center of Minnesota is a community development organization celebrating its 40th year this year. We have, for at least about 15 years, had food programs on the east side of St. Paul. We work with youth and families in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Each year we have at least 20 to 25 teenage youth from Dayton, Bluff, and Payne, Phelan, and other East St. Paul neighborhoods that spend hundreds of hours learning how to grow food in our Garden Corps summer program. There are other youth programs. In addition to sustainable agriculture, we work in cooking and nutrition, ecology and environmental restoration, as well as entrepreneurship and leadership. I'll talk a little bit more about all the wonderful things we're able to do with the food that our kids grow in the summer program. In addition to growing thousands of pounds of food that they're able to sell at a weekly market stand in the neighborhood, sell to 27 families with a weekly CSA program in the summer, they also are able to donate hundreds of pounds of food to local food shelves each year. So the youth in this program are learning both how to grow the food, how to cook the food in a healthy way, how to market that food, and then how to get that food to people in their community who might be experiencing food access issues. And certainly these neighborhoods that we're working in have a high poverty rate and low car ownership rates, and are also experiencing a lot of the BMI and diabetes and childhood obesity issues as well. We are working in partnership in the Myriad Partnerships, which is helping us to leverage a lot of community energy and resources. We work with many different schools in K-12 as well as higher ed. We have right now four different interns that are working with us from universities and colleges. And we are also working with local businesses and other community volunteers that year-round we're able to reach youth during the school day to cook with the healthy food, as well as after school and during the summer when we spend these hundreds of hours with all of the with the youth. We really believe that we're building a green jobs pipeline for youth in St. Paul and Minneapolis, particularly the youth that we're working with, low-income youth, youth of color. We work with a lot of Hmong youth, Latino, African-American, and other youth who've expressed interest in learning the skills that we're able to offer. We have seven large garden plots on the east side of St. Paul, and through those garden plots, we're partnering not just with businesses, we're partnering with faith communities, we're partnering with all kinds of different members of the community who have found that there is a high demand, a growing demand for this food. Each year we have more and more teenagers who express interest in learning about how to grow food, parents who want their kids to either not lose the skills that their families brought here when they immigrated, or to reconnect with those skills, and also growing demand for our CSA program and the food from our markets. So we really see a huge opportunity here with potential investment opportunity that might arise to really respond to that interest and help these kids to really to realize their potential to be our next wonderful professionals in the food area of green jobs.
Okay, very good. Welcome. Introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Greg Reynolds, Delano, Minnesota. My wife and I own and operate Riverbend Farm. We're an organic vegetable farm. We have three primary markets, restaurants, co-op grocery stores in the cities, and we have a CSA, a community-supported agriculture program, which, if you don't know, it's like a subscription for vegetables. People pay in the beginning of the year and get a share every week. I think this is local food and green jobs is an important issue that on several levels. It's a great opportunity for farms. Our CSA, or all the CSAs in the Twin Cities, sold out last year. We increased our share number by 15% this year, raised our price by 15%, and we're sold out a month early. There's a huge demand for local food. The farm to school program is probably the most important part of this. It has at least three benefits. And for farmers, it's an increased market. One of the suburban school districts is looking at putting more local food in, and if you extend their numbers to a statewide, it's millions of dollars and thousands of tons of food. So it's a huge new market for local growers. One of the things that's happening now is that the economy is a little soft, and so childhood poverty is increasing. So these school kids, their lunch may be the best meal of their day. And if they get breakfast and lunch, that may be the best meal that they'll eat. And children have to have good nutrition to be able to learn. I can tell you from our grandchildren, if they go out and have dinner at McDonald's or other fast food restaurants or have ice cream before they come to us, they're wild. I mean, they're unmanageable. If they eat with us, they're ready for a story, some coloring, and they're ready to go to bed. It's a much, it's a night and day comparison. One of the things with the federal food program is that they basically subsidize milk, meat, cheese, and corn. It's a fast food diet for our school kids. And that doesn't put them in a good situation. That doesn't let them learn. Doesn't let them focus on what they need to do to learn. And local foods, Appleton, Wisconsin, is my poster child. They've done a special needs high school where the kids that washed out of every other high school went there. The Natural Bakeries in Manitowoc set up a kitchen, provided the food. It was a whole food diet, more or less. The problems with the kids went way down. The amount that they learned went way up. It's providing better food to the kids is increases the effectiveness of education spending. It's pennies on the dollar for what the education budget is. At, you know, it's like planting a garden and not watering it not to do this. So I think that a study like this is really important to quantify the needs, to say, you know, this is really what we have and what we need and what the potential is, because nobody will start, you know, will stick their neck out and start a farm unless they know that there's a place for it to go.
Okay, very good. Just for my curiosity, I can't remember if you said or not, how many, this coming year, how many people will you be serving in your CSA?
We'll have 80 this year.
80? And how many acres do you have to support that? What's it take you? What size acreage to support an 80-member of Delano?
You know, it's hard because a quarter of our market is CSA, a quarter of it is co-op, and half of it goes to restaurants. Okay. And we do about 10 acres of vegetables.
Total?
Total. So I'm guessing 2 acres or less.
Okay. All right. Very good.
Good morning. My name is Starla Krause, and my sister and I, Robin Krause, founded the Schoolyard Kids Cook Schoolyard Garden in North Minneapolis 5 years ago. This is our fourth year in our garden planting season. And I want to just piggyback on what Greg said, that in what we have seen in the last 5 years is incredible. We have seen kids that did not maybe really pay that much attention to us to now every day in the hallway, which we could be there every day working with these kids, and every day they say, when are you coming to my classroom again? When do we get to go in the garden, or when do we start cooking again? We can't, there can't be enough of us right now. We have the founding partners are three of us, and then we have about 5 volunteers. Our school is about 350 kids, 70% poverty rate. And these kids just love to come to school now. We have a Hmong family that they didn't come to school until they started. I mean, they came, but they came haphazardly. And now when they were introduced to Kids Cook last year, she's always in school. Her reading hasn't improved. And her reading has probably improved because every time they come to our classroom, we always have fresh fruits and vegetables. We can never have enough. You should see them with a bowl full of lemons that maybe we're making lemon sauce for or lemon vinaigrette. They're eating the peels of the lemon. Now, what does that tell you? It tells you that they're vitamin deprived. As Greg said, with our school lunch program the way it is now, it's fast food. And when we just, and granted, there's more fresh fruits available now in the school lunch, but it comes packaged. Or like I was in the school lunchroom last week, and they, you know, the whole apple or the whole pear, it's not ripe yet. They need farmers like Greg, or they need people like me or Winona to be there promoting these products. And that can be in the green economy. It needs to be in the green economy. We need to be in the lunchroom so these kids can learn, because there's no point in having your school keep raising school funding if you're not feeding them properly, because that's where it all begins. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you.
I just
said,
Mr. Chairman, people who would like to testify on the
other
part of the building.
Okay.
And then we'll be back.
Ready?
Good morning. My name is Margaret Adamek. I work at the University of Minnesota, and my focus is on local foods. We're particularly interested in amendments. The last year and a half, I have worked with rural communities around the state of Minnesota for a University of Minnesota program called the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. And I conducted 6 strategic planning sessions in 5 regions of the state in greater Minnesota, asking the question about, okay, all of you are working in the domain of local foods, what kind of long-term outcomes would you like to see? And invariably what folks talked about, regardless of the geography or the growing zone that they were in, whether they were fruit and vegetable producers or livestock producers, was we need some attention paid to infrastructure issues, because there's a lot of activity at the grassroots community level that focuses on community dinners, linking farmers with local restaurants, creating farmers markets in a parking lot in a local church or a local shopping mall. But what we really run into again and again is some of these infrastructure issues: distribution, processing, post-harvest handling, aggregation of supply, scale-appropriate distribution routes that work really well and effectively, like the larger scale distribution and processing, but accommodate the fact that these are smaller growers over a geographic distance. We've also heard in those planning sessions the need for farm to school, which has been really well articulated by the previous folks who were testifying. And so what we've heard out of this is actually also mirrored in the Twin Cities. I've been participating in an initiative with the city of Minneapolis called Homegrown Minneapolis that is trying to create their own long-range plan around food self-sufficiency for an urban area, which actually sounds kind of like kind of ironic given how much of our food supply we rely on other people to produce. But we're seeing this nationwide. The New York Times just this past week wrote an article, and they call it the food revolution, but what they're saying is a lot of families, communities, and cities are stepping up and thinking about how they can become more food self-sufficient, how it links to green jobs in a new economy, and how it links to public health outcomes. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about how this relates to the Local Foods Commission. The idea behind the Local Foods Commission is a fewfold. Number one, there are a number of organizations and agencies that work in some way with local foods, whether it's the Minnesota Grown Program who works with marketing local foods, whether it's organizations like IATP working on farm-to-school initiatives, whether it's nonprofit organizations that work directly with farmers, small-scale farmers like Land Stewardship Project or Sustainable Farming Association or other organizations. And what we would like to do is have a cross-sector commission. So it's not just the usual suspects of agriculture and NGOs. We also include philanthropy, we include healthcare, we include higher education, we include K-12. And what this commission would like to do is lay out a long-term blueprint to plan our food self-sufficiency as a state and the role that each of these sectors will play collaboratively. So it's not just up to state government to figure this out. What are the partnerships that we can forge over the long haul? And this commission would serve that purpose. So we come out of it with a long-range framework with recommendations for policies, but we'd also be able to articulate what role can philanthropy play in this? What role can healthcare step up and say, we are interested in prevention and we care about public health? We believe fresh, healthy food plays a role in that. And so we see this as a long-term view of all of these sectors coming together to plan our food self-sufficiency and protect Minnesota's public health.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, what role does a large local farm play in this?
At this point, what we're trying to do is, you know, agriculture covers a broad spectrum, right? From very small scale, you know, sometimes I call them nano farms because I'm not quite sure when a large garden becomes a small farm. And so we've got that end of the continuum all the way up to large scale agriculture. And what we're interested right now with the Local Foods Commission is because so many of the folks active in this movement are really focusing on smaller scale, we're interested in seeing what long-term role that scale of food production is going to play in feeding Minnesotans. So it's not an instead of, it's getting a clear sense of what we should be doing to be more effective, to be that sector of agriculture and provide those resources to the state.
Well, thank you for that, because I agree. We're all in this together, regardless of size and whatnot. Whether you're a large farm or a small farm, whether you're organic or more conventional, everybody produces a good, safe, wholesome product at a reasonable cost, actually the lowest cost in the world. And so, again, there's room for everybody. We're all in this together, and so we don't want to exclude anybody. So I thank you for that.
That's right. Thank you.
Welcome.
Good morning. I appreciate the opportunity to speak, Mr. Chair and other committee members. My name is Joanne Birkenkamp. I direct the Local Foods Program for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis. And I know we're running a bit long. I'm going to keep my comments short, but I wanted to speak to you in particular about the Local Foods Commission and its role in supporting farm to school. And I think many of our speakers this morning have spoken eloquently to the benefits of farm to school, in terms of helping kids be ready to learn, in terms of getting better nutritional outcomes, dealing with the vast increase in diabetes and overweight that we're seeing among our children today. Among children born in the year 2000, 1 in 3 will get diabetes. If a child is Hispanic or black, that number goes up to 1 in 2. So, you know, food matters. What kids eat really matters. And schools particularly matter because for many of our kids, they're getting much of their nutrition in school. And school food is their best opportunity to get a square meal. So farm to school is important to us for those reasons, as well as the potential economic benefit. In the state of Minnesota, in the federal school lunch program, there's about $100 million of food per year that is purchased for school food programs. Very little of that is local. Very little of it is grown in Minnesota. And I think it would behoove our economy if we were finding some ways to keep more of those dollars in our state. And farm to school has the potential to do that. There's also been a recent study that came out from the state of Oregon showing that when non-local school food is replaced with locally grown, the multiplier is about 2 to 1. And there are very clear economic benefits from farm to school programs. So I wanted to draw your attention to two particular pieces. One of the things that we at ITB have been working on is we're working in partnership with the Minnesota School Nutrition Association. That's the affiliation of school food service directors, who are the ones who are really responsible for what food gets onto the tray. We did a survey with them among school food service directors across the state and found that about 40% said they are very interested in buying locally grown from farmers directly. About 60% are interested in getting locally grown through distributors, through their produce distributors, who are able to, for instance, process that product so that it's in a ready-to-use form. That reflects a very significant increase in interest among our schools. And I think, for instance, school districts like Wilmer have really pioneered how to make farm to school work. They've got models that are well developed. They're being documented and put on a website that will be available to schools across the state of Minnesota and nationally. And they really provide an example of how to make these programs work. So the interest among schools is rapidly increasing. The other thing I would tell you is that 17 states across the country have passed significant farm to school legislation. And that we have a list of those for you. This material will be made available to you. But this is something that's happening across the country, and I hope that it can happen here, and we appreciate your consideration.
Very good. Any questions from the members? All right. We all understand the importance, and it is happening. And again, I want you folks to also meet, hopefully, with Representative Hodge and Clark and the Minnesota Grown folks, too, to get a better understanding on how we can all coordinate this. Representative Magan.
Question on the bill, Mr. Chairman. Okay. First, 1740, House File 1747, I guess we're... Ari is volunteering, as I understood it from the testifiers and from Ari, they're volunteering to do this work. I don't know how much they're going to volunteer if their budgets are cut. That's a question I do have if Ari wants to come down and talk about
they
that.
They did testify already, and they said that as long as they weren't cut in half, like was recommended, they're already doing this work, and this is just broadening slightly what they're already doing. So as long as we keep it a reasonable cut, it's already in the works over there, so they'll just continue what they're already started.
Well, that's to understand I'd like to have, Mr. Chairman, because we're asking for a report no later than January 15th of 2010, and I hate to have them come in and a couple months down the road here and say, well, we've got cuts, so we can't do it, so we got to find some money somewhere to do it, number one. And then number two, in the appropriations, I'm not aware of any appropriations from the federal bailout program here to the Department of Ag for grants to fund this to the department.
Right.
And if you come down and testify, because again, we're asking for reports and all of this, and I could write the report for them. If there's no money available.
And Representative Magnus, I love you like a brother, but we already talked about all this before you got in the room. But we're happy to have him come down for you again. But we did state that we don't know yet if there's federal money. We probably won't know for a couple months. And if there isn't, of course, it's a moot point. And if there is, then this just directs some ideas on how that money may be utilized if it comes into the department. But if it doesn't, that's the end of the story. So,
Kate. Mr. Chairman,
if you want more from the department, we can bring them down.
No, just so we have an understanding among the members and us, Mr. Chairman, my concern is that we've got tough times here, so we're trying to figure out how to manage the cuts we're going to have to face or revenue increases we're going to have to put in place, and yet we keep talking about funding. And I think on the Representative Hodge's amendment, our bill that we've amended onto this, we've got, I think, 26 members, as I understand it, or at least
up to 26 members, and they're supposed to get funded, and I'm concerned about how they're going to get funded too.
Mr. Chairman, or maybe Representative Hodge.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Magnus, I think you have a good point with the amount of members, and that's one of the reasons why they can have subcommittees. You know, what started out as, an innocent desire to see some farm-to-school initiatives happen, I quickly found out how difficult and complicated the issue could be. I know that I'll be working with the Department of Agriculture and the University of Minnesota to try to make sure that costs aren't a big factor on this. I do know that there's some local fundraising initiatives to try to support this, too.
Well, again, Mr. Chairman, that's my concern, because if you're going to, you know, it says here lines 1.14, lines 1.15, commission members must be compensated according to these statutes, and there's a lot of members, and I don't know, it doesn't state here how many meetings they're going to have, if they're going to have one, if they're going to have 20. I don't know that. I don't know. I don't see a fiscal note for an impact on this. You know, the university's in front of us every day asking for more money. They said they're going to fundraise this stuff. These are all questions I've got, Mr. Chairman.
No, and there will be, Representative Magnus, any of our bills before they go in will have to have fiscal notes. And now that they've been presented to the committee, now fiscal notes can be prepared. So we've seen them now. We've seen the amendment. Now we expect the university and the Department of Agriculture will provide fiscal notes on it.
Mr. Chairman, I might set Subdivision Magnus is minor easy to see. Check that subdivision. My understanding is there's no cost to the state. They did not get per diem or...
Well, he is right on the Hosh bill, Representative Clark. It does say they'll be compensated per diem and travel and things. So that is in the Hosh bill, but we can... Representative Hosh?
Subdivision 3 should not... Well, maybe we can look it up there.
Mr. Chair, on the A2 amendment, I think that's one area that we could definitely remove.
Right.
We'll be in discussion on that.
So we'll be looking at the cost factors in there. But in the amendment, there are costs.
Representative Welty. Nope.
Any other questions? A comment from Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I also love like a brother.
Thank you. Right back at you. You know that. You know that. Representative Clark, you know, the purpose of my question earlier, and I hope people understand, I've had very nice conversations with Representative Otremba and others about the importance of knowing and understanding and being involved in food production and stuff like that. I think that's a great idea. Everybody needs to understand that. I don't want it to ever become an issue where we pit one segment of agriculture against the other or anything like that, because we're not only feeding our neighbors, we're feeding, you know, the people in the United States, we're feeding people around the world, and so we are all in this together. And so I want people to understand that. I want people to realize that there's room for everybody. And we in agriculture, in the state of Minnesota and the nation, we produce a very safe, wholesome, good-tasting product that is the lowest cost. And so, again, we're all in this together. There's room for everybody, and I just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Representative Clark.
I certainly appreciate that, and I can just say as a former farm kid who grew up on a farm many years ago, and as a...
And which town was that?
Well, it was between Edgerton and Laverne, so...
That'd be in Magnus's district, right?
It was. It is. I see his constituents quite often.
All right. I see your dad, too.
So, I mean, I have... This is close to home from a very early age. I love being on the farm, and we... You know, we struggle to make a living, and I think today it's the case too that people on farms are really struggling. And I think some of what we're trying to do here with the green job sector is make sure that farms don't get left out. And when we brought this discussion into the green job task force, it really wasn't there until we really pushed it and said, "Wait a minute, this sector is really important." And working with Kate, we did have that discussion about we want to make sure we're including all folks. And that's why the language is as it is. And she was very clear in helping get that language put together. And the other thing I want to say is, as people were talking today, I think one of the things that was really important to me is we have hungry people, despite the fact that we have, you know, prolific farming in some cases and in other cases not. there are food deserts, you know, is kind of what they talk about in areas like mine. Now I live in the inner city, and people have a hard time accessing food. So there's room and need for, I think, all of what was being talked about here, and I think what doesn't usually get talked about are the areas, perhaps like where I live now, where people have a hard time finding adequate food. It's very interesting. The food shelves have been seeing such a huge demand now in one of the main places in the suburbs, and that there's a lot of hungry people there, too. So I think that, you know, the Obama family started a garden in their backyard at the White House. That's the kind of thing, victory garden, I guess, that we know about maybe from the previous generation. And so I just wanted to say I think there is room for everybody, and there's some new needs and some old ways, I think, to bring all this together, too. So I appreciate the committee's, you know, listening to the testimony today, and I really do hope we can find some federal funds, Mr. Chairman.
I was going to mention that the chefs at the White House now will be out harvesting their own herbs and tomatoes and stuff to feed at the table there. Any more questions to the folks at the table? Anyone else want to testify on this bill in the audience? Okay. Seeing none. Thank you, Representative Clark. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Anderson, explain yourself and this large crowd that just came into the room.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pleased to report today that we have a ninth grade civics class from BDE, which is Belgrade, Bruton, El Rosa. Great bunch of kids. They're very well behaved. Their teachers are Chuck Marks and what I used to call Mandy Palsy, Mandy Primus. So welcome.
Welcome, everybody. You're in the Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs Committee, and Chair Junkie has a bill up next, so he's handing the gavel over temporarily, well, maybe permanently if I have any say in it, but temporarily at this point. So, Representative Junkie, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move House File 839 to the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And members and Mr. Chair, I brought people along. This is a bill pertaining to the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab and an appropriation, and I think they're the best ones to explain it, the doctors over there.
All right. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, I'm Trevor Ames. I'm the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Minnesota, and Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Dr. Collins, who is the director of the Diagnostic Lab at the University of Minnesota, and I are here to testify in support of House File 839, which is a bill that requests additional state support for the University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. The planned use of the $1.25 million per year, if appropriated to the Department of Agriculture, is intended to support the critical diagnostic lab service functions of rapid disease detection and emergency response. The VDL's primary role is to protect the state's health and well-being, and inadequate support for the veterinary diagnostic lab threatens not only the economic viability of the Minnesota's animal agricultural industry, but also compromises the state safeguards for public health. Every year, the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab runs millions of tests to help producers and veterinarians make sound management decisions about the state's livestock regarding such diseases as porcine reproductive syndrome, respiratory and reproductive syndrome in pigs, and avian pneumovirus in turkeys and chickens. The Veterinary Diagnostic Lab does an extensive testing as well to support Minnesota's Departments of Health and Natural Resources and Agriculture, as well as performing thousands of tests for the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. It is the official laboratory for the Minnesota Board of Animal Health, and it helps the board by helping to control regulated diseases like tuberculosis and Yoni's disease of dairy cattle. The Veterinary Diagnostic Lab also responds to emergencies, as was illustrated last year when it collaborated with the Minnesota Department of Health, and it supported Department of Health's investigation to determine the cause of a neurologic disease designated as progressive inflammatory neuropathy that was affecting pork plant workers in an Austin pork plant. Thankfully, the lab was able to determine that no known swine diseases were being involved and being transmitted to these workers. In cases like this, a rapid, accurate emergency response is required by the state as a prerequisite to sustain animal agriculture, protect food supply, and maintain human health. Inadequate funding for the veterinary diagnostic lab has put its accreditation at risk. In order to maintain a national accreditation status, the American Association of Veterinary Laboratory Diagnosticians will conduct accreditation site visits, and they determine whether diagnostic labs are providing high-quality service to animal agriculture, the state agencies, and human agencies as well. The most recent accreditation review of the veterinary diagnostic lab in Minnesota by this organization was conducted last fall, and it found the level of state support to be too low to maintain full accreditation. And to quote from their executive summary regarding this accreditation report on a section that deals with the importance of stable funding for the diagnostic lab, they stated, "As diagnostic labs are a vital part of disease surveillance and monitoring, finances must be available to sustain these assignments. Since these laboratories serve the public good, surveillance resources are not intended to be self-sufficient financially and require public financial support commensurate with the public good derived." Last fall, as I mentioned, the accreditation review gave the diagnostic lab one full year of full accreditation instead of the customary 5 years. The accreditation status will be reviewed again in December of this year. Without adequate funding, the veterinary diagnostic lab is at risk of losing its accreditation, thus impacting Minnesota's $600 million animal agriculture export revenues. So we strongly encourage you to support this request for increased funding for the veterinary diagnostic lab, even in these difficult times, as it will ensure the needed capacity for protecting Minnesota's many agricultural jobs, keep our 5 million citizens healthy, and ensure the well-being of millions of animals within the state. We can't predict all of the diseases of tomorrow, but an investment today will ensure Minnesota's leadership in agriculture. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ames. Any questions? Seeing none, we'll keep. Oh, Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you briefly tell us what the problems were, what the issues were, why you didn't get the 5-year license to the 1 year?
I'll let Dr. Collins respond to that.
Dr. Collins, please state your name for the record.
Dr. Jim Collins, Director of the University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. Mr. Chair and committee members, the accreditation site visit went extraordinarily well, and only minor deficiencies were found except for in a deficiency of public support. Originally, in years past, we've gone from fully public-supported laboratory to where now producers are paying 80% of the funding for the laboratory in terms of user fees. The accreditation committee of the AVLD is concerned about the privatization of the laboratory in that regard.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this be because of Governor Puente's increase in fees to everybody that this has happened then?
Dr. Collins?
No, Mr. Chair, committee members, the fee structure was actually implemented in the 1970s. Since that time, obviously, there's been a tendency then for the fees to rise and the public subsidy to decline or stay even. And so we've gone from being about 25% of public support or private user fee dependency to now about 80% user fee dependency, and so it's been a long time coming in that regard.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Does this mean then that the fee structure will decrease with this additional funding?
Dr. Collins.
We would hope that it would. What it would do is, would it prevent further increases in fees? I don't think we'll be able to roll back fees, but we certainly want to keep the fees stable from here forward, because what's happening is it's becoming cost prohibitive for agriculture to use the laboratory, in which case our submissions decline and our disease surveillance suffers. The mission of this lab is to find a disease the first time and the earliest time it occurs so we can mitigate the economic damage to the state. So we need material coming through the laboratory in a reasonable number for our disease surveillance function.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Representative Duncan.
Can you just tell the committee, is this the bottom line that you need for money? And if you get this, you're at 80% user fees, what will you be at with this? What percent?
Dr. Collins? Like take that one?
And is there a level recommended for the accreditation board?
The accreditation board did not recommend any level of funding. They just said it was deficient, and they left it up to the state and the university and agriculture to decide what level of funding it's going to take to meet this requirement. I suspect that the success of this bill will enable us to pass accreditation with no problem.
I would.
That kind of helps, Mr. Chair, but not a lot. Again, we're looking for a bottom line number. We can certainly visit on it more. What is your current general fund?
Got down.
$1.7 million in terms of the state special.
And this would be on top.
Representative Duncan. Okay. Any other questions? We do have one other testifier, Representative Junkie, if they'd like to come up and testify, or possibly two. Please, three, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Me Too. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work for the Minnesota Pork Producers. And I think the reason that you do have three people representing different sectors of agriculture all sitting here is because all of us recognize really how important this is. With Minnesota Pork Producers, we have now, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure you know, have moved into the number two position in the United States in terms of hogs raised in this country. And so we used to be number three. We've just recently moved into number two. One of the reasons for that is given credit, at least by the association I represent, is in part because of the Vet Diagnostic Lab and the importance it plays. It's already been discussed, the fact that 80% is now being funded by the people using it, and that's that's been a big change over the years. But it really has played a very important place in a number of PRRS was mentioned, and a number of other diseases in the state, and so really here to emphasize how important it is to livestock agriculture in Minnesota.
Thank you. Please,
Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Me Too. Bruce Clavin here. I represent the Minnesota Turkey Growers, the Broiler and Egg Association, and Minnesota State Cattlemen, and just echo Mr. Schoenfeld's testimony. Our members are in strong support of the Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory funding. We've seen this for avian pneumovirus in turkeys, and then, of course, TB last year. Getting on top of that last year right away helped prevent a statewide outbreak. So just to echo the comments. Thank you.
Very nice. Me three.
Exactly. Me three. Well, since Mr. Clavin and Mr. Schoenfeld kind of stole my thunder on this one being the last one, but I do want to point out that it is important
to... Please.
I'm sorry. Corey Bennett, representing the Minnesota Agri Girls Council. I do want to echo their comments, but it's also not only the producers of the state that this facility helps to protect. It's also the agribusinesses and the processing facilities across Minnesota that say this facility helps to protect. It's one of the premier facilities in the country, and it's a true asset to not only the producer section, but also the agri-processing and agro-business sections across our state. So I want to thank Mr. Junkie for bringing this forward. I know times are tough and budgets are tight, but if it's possible we could keep this project in mind as we put our budgets together, we'd be grateful. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifiers? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question to the department again. Dr. Collins, was that in the current biennium we're in now, is that 1.7 a year or for the total biennium?
Dr. Collins, could you come up and answer the question, please?
Committee members, Chairman, Mr. Chairman, the $1.7 million is per year.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it states in the bill, Mike, this is what you want to keep that, maintain that funding level at 1.7 plus to have the...
Exactly. Yeah.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
One more testifier.
Please state your name and
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Tom Hagerty. I'm a veterinarian, and I represent the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, and I need to also... because the laboratory is important in the surveillance mode for any disease that might come up, it's so important to the state of Minnesota, to the people of the state of Minnesota, And that's why public funding for this is so important. And as the percentage of public funding has gotten less, the people really aren't getting what they don't realize they need. But the surveillance piece is more important. So I encourage this. We support this. Encourage this.
Thanks so much for your testimony. Representative Junkie?
Yes.
Any closing words? All right. House File 839 will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, I move House File 838 before the Committee for Possible Inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Please proceed. House File 838 members, if you remember a couple of years ago, we established the Agriculture, Fertilizer Research and Education Council, and they have been up and running, and in fact, we appropriated $600,000 to them for their first round of grants and cash. For those that were on the committee, remember the discussions, there are a number of ways talked about financing this. There's cash, like we did. The original financing mechanism by the task force that developed this would have been a refundable tonnage fee checkoff on your fertilizer, which again, we ran into some snags on that, and we continue to try and understand the cost involved there. We think a checkoff's a good way to go, but at this point we haven't figured out a way for the department to bring it down to a reasonable cost for writing checks out to people on a refund. And just as an example, if you had a, let's say you're 1,000 acres, you're probably looking at 3 or 4 cents an acre on the tonnage fee that would be on. So you're talking about, you know, 30, 40 bucks. And to write a check for 30, 40 bucks, at one point I think the department was saying it cost them $50 a check or something to write the checks back. And so, you know, I think the checkoff's still a good way to go, but we have to figure out a mechanism, and we're thinking that through for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Or, as Senator Dill over in the Senate and others have said, just put the straight fee on the tonnage tax, and forget about the checkoff. We need the research, and it's a good group, and they're moving forward. And certainly I've heard from some of the members that that would be acceptable also. That's how Wisconsin and Iowa funds theirs. And so basically what this group does, to remind folks, is they take this money and solicit RFPs for fertility research in the state that's needed. So you'll see in here that we requested clean water funds. At first we thought maybe that's the way to go about it, but two things will probably be concerning about that. Number one, are we supplanting what we're already doing with clean water funds, which is kind of a no-no? And number two, again, this is a temporary situation. So every year or two, we got to come back and figure out again, do we go back to them for more? Do we fund it somehow? So we're trying to get some stability into it this year also. But members and Mr. Chair, I just want to get it here before the committee. It's certainly something that you and we may see and talk about in the omnibus bill here in a few weeks. I don't know if anyone else, I know Mr. Bond is here. His group has been involved pretty intimately with this, and he can probably give you an update on how the some of the money was allocated. And by the way, there's an education piece in here, too, that he may want to explain. I think they're involved with his group in the short course and some other things, too.
Right. Thank you. Please state your name for the
record. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bill Bond, representing Minnesota Crop Production Retailers, members of the committee, Representative Junkie. We strongly support the council and its efforts. It is the right thing to do. The right people are involved in the council. They have funded worked very aggressively to set up a very good organization that's responsive to each of their members. You've got most of the major ag producer groups and crop input organizations involved in the leadership of it on the council. And they funded some very important production research that has not been moving forward heretofore. And so that council has really provided modern crop production research for the producers and for those that advise the producers in Minnesota. And as well, there's been an educational outreach regarding the best management practices that was made possible by this. And it is an excellent effort. We are supportive of other means of financing it. We want it to be a stable source of financing, and until we get that settled, this is a good way to keep it moving, and so we strongly support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strong. Any questions? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bond and possibly Representative Junkie, we currently do pay some fees on fertilizer by the ton, and could you just, for the sake of review and information, outline what happens to those fees currently?
We'd like to take it.
Currently, we're at about, I think, 30 cents a ton. Compared to Wisconsin, Iowa, they're near 70, 80 cents a ton. And so one of the options is just to add about 40 cents a ton onto the fertilizer fee. It'll be comparable to our state, so it's not a disadvantage retail-wise. And again, that probably doesn't discern where you buy your fertilizer anyway for that small amount per ton. And again, what we're looking at is probably 3 or 4 cents an acre. So again, you can extrapolate that back to your farm. And that was the original recommendation from the group, was to do it that way with a checkoff for if there was some that didn't want to participate, although we suspect, like with most checkoffs, once it in, it is in, and we're realizing the value of this. In fact, I mean, this is your research for fertility. The less fertilizer you can use at $1,000 a ton nitrogen and other things will well pay for this over and over and over again. But again, at 3 or 4 cents an acre, we suspect most folks would not have a problem with that checkoff. The original group, Representative Torkelson, was made up of that recommended this was made up of the group that now sits on the board. In fact, it was chaired by the Farm Bureau member at the time, and Farmers Union and the producer group, the university, the fertilizer industry, the retailers are all sitting on this group. It's a real eclectic group that we haven't really put together in the state before, and I think it is working very well.
Representative Torkelson?
And just to follow up, and also what's happening to those dollars that are being currently raised?
Chair John.
Maybe Mr. Bond can...
Mr. Bond.
Mr. Chairman, I think I would defer to the department as far as the specific use of the current money, the 30 cents that's being paid now.
Is there someone from the department that would like to...
Well, the current inspection fees? Those fertilizer fees are used to inspect. The department uses them in their plant protection division to actually inspect fertilizer grades. All our fertilizer has to be labeled and tested, spot tested periodically, monitored. Here comes Mr. Bezicki, Mr. Fertility. We call him.
Mr. Fertility, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Greg Bezicki. I'm with the Pest and Fertilizer Management Division. I have three daughters.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Bezicki, you're well qualified.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, as Chairman Junkie, Representative Junkie mentioned, we do those inspection activities. We are also involved in anhydrous ammonia inspection, facility inspection, emergency response, a wide variety of activities that deal with agricultural chemicals. We do cleanups for spill sites. It's all described in our biennial budgets. We spend about on the 30 cents that we receive for regulatory efforts. That amounts to about $1.2 million a year that we use for regulatory oversight and environmental protection programs. And then there also is about a 30 cent per ton fee that is used for the ACRA account, which is used solely for, except for a small administrative fee, that is used solely for the reimbursement for people who go out and do cleanups once they spilled and they properly clean it up.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? We have 2 minutes. Seeing none. Seeing Representative Otremba.
Can anybody get the fees back? So I can vote the other way?
Madam Chair, if we put in a checkoff, then anyone can. What originally entailed would have been once a year you'd collect your fertilizer receipts, fill out a form, send it to the Department of Agriculture, and they'd send back, your 20 or 30 bucks or whatever it was you paid if you didn't want to participate in this. So that's how the original checkoff would have gone. So again, but unfortunately it's like, and again, I don't know if it's exact, but it's like $50 a check we're being quoted to write that $30 check out.
And it's got to be audited. It's an account that has to be established. And so there's a number of fees. I'm not disputing that. And we've had, frankly, a lot of the organizations, corn growers, soybean growers, and others, trying to discover if they could do it through their organization, if there'd be a way to, because they think they can do it for a lot less money than the government can. But as we try and discover that, again, the other option is to just put the fee on and, you know, buck it up like our neighbors do. It's important. No one argues the importance of this. There's just some people that fundamentally have a, you know, like to get a refundable checkoff and, or not. There's some people don't like checkoffs either. We have that debate extensively. I was on the original task force along with Senator Vickerman, Senator Dill, and Representative Blaine back then were on the task force that set this up.
Any other questions? House File 838 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Any announcements, Mr. Chair? All right, meeting adjourned.